Good morning. Can you hear me? Yeah? Okay. It's good to be here with you. The talk today is coming out of breakfast discussion with the residents. And this little family here, they have potatoes and eggs and muffins, and they sit around and talk about Buddhism, the Dharma. And so I want to continue to unfold some things that came up in that conversation. Somebody had asked me a question about practice, and I emphasized that the practice of Zazen is not psychotherapeutic. It's not about introspection. Actually, it reminded me, if you read something that I would recommend, if you haven't read Dogen Zenji's Fukan Zazengi, he gives a big list of what Zazen is not. One of the first things he says, Zazen is not introspection. It's not about understanding your problems through thinking about them. It's not about getting to know your feelings about things. It's not about clarifying who you are in the world, although sometimes that's a side effect of doing Zazen. Because putting down the mind and seeing the mind that needs to be put down in order to do Zazen are two sides of one coin. We want to get disentangled from the mind, the thinking mind, to see what else there is. But as we disentangle from that mind, we really encounter it very intimately. And the way that Dogen Zenji expressed this is to study the way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. And then further even beyond that. Now I'm specifically talking about Zazen, the practice of sitting meditation. And the purpose of a talk like this is to encourage us to let Zazen be Zazen and let everything else you do be that. In a way, we practice a compartmentalization as much as we can, which we can't do perfectly. But we try to practice that compartmentalization. So Zazen is not psychotherapeutic because you're not interested in what you're thinking and why you're thinking. You're interested in letting go of thinking. It's deconstructive of self and personality. And I like to try to find images, and well, the image that came to me is it's a little bit like if you had a shrub outside your window. This is an interesting enough shrub. Different things land in that shrub. Sometimes it flowers or fruits. But that shrub blocked the light that came in to your room because it's in front of the window. You're pruning the shrub. Zazen is like making spare the shrub of the personality. Have you ever been called a shrub before? That's one of those words. If you say it enough, it becomes very strange. Shrub. 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 You're making spare the shrub so that more light can come through the window. In other words, Zazen is being and invitation for something greater than body, mind, personality to shine through. This is why it's a spiritual practice. This is why it's not self-help. This is why it's not something that neatly aligns with a wellness paradigm or a scientific paradigm. Those things could have their place, but we have confidence in Buddha nature. There's something more fundamental than mind, even more fundamental than body. So So we compartmentalize and make Zazen a ritual where we are clear, we're stepping out of the limitation. We're sitting down to step out of the limitation of being a body-mind personality. Of course, we have to work with it, but the way we work with it is very specific. So I mentioned during sitting that no matter what method you're using, it's an interruption of habitual thinking. We're very fascinated with our thoughts and our feelings. We're very fascinated. We're so fascinated that we think about them continually. We think about what we're thinking about. And then we meditate, and then we can really think about what we're thinking about. But that's not what the point is. We're interrupting our fascination with our own thoughts. In some sense, we only have the imperative or the thirst to do Zazen because we need a time when we're not so fascinated, involved with our thoughts. It's a kind of medicine. It's a kind of antidote to a fixation, the addiction to our minds, the identity with our minds. So sometimes I say something provocative like, whatever, no matter what you think in Zazen, it doesn't matter at all. Doesn't matter what you think at all when you're sitting Zazen. Doesn't matter if hell comes or if heaven comes. Now, you could act on thoughts in a way that's harmful. That's another issue. But the particular content of your mind, it doesn't matter. It's all thought, just in a different shape. You could right now give rise to a very mean thought. You're free to do that. You could right now give rise to a very kind thought. You're free to do that. As far as Zazen is concerned, one is not really all that much better than the other. They're just thoughts. We want to relate to ourselves as a phenomena. Just a phenomena. Yeah. We want to relate to all thoughts as merely, simply thoughts. In Zazen, there's a time for other ways of relating to ourselves. So in Zazen, the particular things that are arising in our mind and our feelings often don't matter at all, and they don't have any particular meaning. Just because we have sat in this situation and we feel or think something in particular doesn't mean that it means something. It's just a thought happened. It's just a feeling happened. You can make meaning of it. It might have meaning as far as there's something going on in your life that you stop and pay attention and you see it more clearly. It means that something is going on in your life. But the thought itself, it means only as much or as little as you make of it. But Zazen is not a meaning-making activity. Because what we're interested in is not being fascinated by the clouds, so to speak. You see, it's a shift in view. It's a shift in orientation. To make this a compartment, a ritual, whereby we are interested in the universal rather than the particular, is one way to say it. And in trying to do so, you probably will have great insights over time about your emotional, relational life, because attention, as it gets increasingly disentangled from thought, has a wisdom, and that wisdom sees things. But that's, those insights about our emotional life, our relational life, are a secondary point. Right? So I want to talk, well then what are we doing? I'm going to talk a little bit more particularly about that. A could say traditionally there are three modes of zazen. Right? And it's important to bring clarity to what we're doing. Sometimes we approach zazen, we come to meditate, and we have heard so many instructions from so many different people that we're sitting down with an actual competition in our minds about what's the right thing to do. Because we have received all kinds of people that seem to have some authority. We respect them, they have a YouTube channel. Many people are following that YouTube channel. This person must know what they're talking about. And they say something to us about meditation and we go, oh yeah, that really rings true. And then someone else says something and we're like, well, that kind of rings true too. And so in the background, there's a kind of lack of confidence in just doing one thing. And so how that tends to play out is we sit down, and let's say we're meditating for 40 minutes. Within 40 minutes, the mind roams between six different methods. Let me try a little bit of this over here. Let me sprinkle in a little bit of that. I heard about this. And we actually have a diffuse practice then. We actually have the restless mind has gotten a hold of spiritual practice. And it's just an elevated form of that. Maybe that's the worst case. Probably it's all okay, and it will work out just fine. But in case it won't, that's what this talk is for. So there are basically three modes of Zen practice, and I'm speaking more as the lineage as it first came to us before we decided, well, we're modern people and we need this, that, and the third as part of our practice, which may be wisdom. Right? We will only really know in hindsight if we can know. So the first mode or method of Zazen practice is, I like this word shamatha. It comes from the Indo-Tibetan tradition. It's really the same word as zen. And it means calm abiding. This is the practices of focused attention. And when we are practicing focused attention, the idea is that whatever our object is, let's say it's your hand, it could be your breath, it could be sound, it could be your butt on the cushion, you have the object, you have committed to that object. And you have attention, which always wants to move around. Whether that's for habit or desire, that's another talk. Attention is always wanting to move around among our field of experience. In shamatha, in concentration meditation, the task is for these two things to stay together. So you have a whole field of experience. Internally, you have sensations, thoughts, perceptions. Externally, you have the sense fields. In shamatha, you are committing, if you're doing the method, breath and attention are going to stay together. Everything else, not important. Not important. The method depends on this. Depends on, I commit to this object, keeping attention, touching it. And the experience of that is that it keeps bouncing off. And it goes into your thoughts, and it goes into your knee, then it goes into the forest, and then it goes, it just keeps going. But our intention brings attention back to the object. This is the kind of process. It keeps bouncing off and going away. But every moment where attention and object are touching is a moment of shamatha, is a moment of concentration. The idea is to extend this touching as much as possible, to deepen this touching through the just the simple act of bringing attention back to it. And you could see why you have to choose one object. Because if you don't, then the practice itself becomes another form of mind wandering. Something goes, well, what should I pay attention to? The teacher said the breath, but I don't like the breath. Or teacher said this feeling of my hands, but that doesn't seem sophisticated enough, because what did Rupert Spira say? Or whatever your version is. And so then the method starts to actually lose its potency. It becomes compromised because we don't have confidence in the logic of this training. In the practice of shamatha, we're amplifying our capacity for stable attention. Sometimes people use language like the ability to hold the mind steady. But specifically, there is always an object and there's always attention, and we're trying to bring those together. That can be subtle. Sometimes the object is resting in space or silence, the kind of things that sometimes Hogen Roshi likes to teach. When you hear somebody teach a method, it's important to really understand what they're saying that you are to do. What am I supposed to do? So if someone, Zen teacher, says, rest in stillness, they are saying that stillness is an object, however subtle, that you keep returning your attention to. That depends on you knowing what they're talking about. That's why most teachers say breath, because everybody pretty much knows what or where breath is. Pretty much. I was thinking of the word stable. And then I thought of a pony in a stable. And I thought that's actually kind of a good metaphor, a stable. Because if you're a rambunctious pony, if your mind is a rambunctious pony, a rambunctious pony loves to run around. That's what it is. That's its life. It's a rambunctious pony. But actually, it might also, and I've never asked a pony, but some of you might talk to ponies, it might actually like being put in the stable, because finally it's like, oh, okay, I can just chill here. I kind of like being a pony in a stable. My cats are kind of like this. They hate to be controlled unless they agree to it. But then if you get them in like the right, if you swaddle them in a blanket, or if they get in the right box, they're like, oh, I love it in this box. This is great. Why aren't people talking about this? But just like us, they pop out and they forget how nice it was in there. And they're just running around again, restless. And you don't put the pony in the stable to punish it. You're not letting go of your thoughts because you're bad or because they're bad. You're letting go of them as a skillful means. Because if you don't, there's something you are not going to be in relationship with, something important. That's the idea. Now, a finer point about shamatha is it's not about stopping thoughts. That's a secondary effect. And why this is important is something like this. Let's say you are meditating on a candle flame. That's one of my favorite shamatha practices. You're sitting at home. Practice is pure and simple. See that flame. As soon as mind carries you away, you're not really seeing it anymore, you bring your attention back. And eventually attention and flame begin to kind of merge together as that deepens. You can be in that mergedness. You can have attention resting in the flow of the breath, and thoughts are emitting. The brain secretes thoughts. If we think the point is to have no thoughts, then what happens is we go, oh, there's some thoughts. And very quickly, we leave our attention from the breath, and we're over there trying to bat those things away. We're doing whatever we kind of do when we're like, oh, I'm going to swat that. Then you split the method into something it's not. There is no method of swatting away thoughts in Zen. There is no method of directly trying to stop thoughts. You could do that. People can learn that. But there's a reason why that's not a method, and part of it is this. Because in life, you're going to need to be present with things, And still, your brain is going to emit thoughts. And you don't want a dichotomy of there being thoughts and you being present splitting your life in half. That's a false dichotomy. Anyone who's played a musical instrument knows that, for example, if you're in a band, you're in a absorption of attention in the flow of what you're doing, and you're also thinking, what's coming up in the next bar? Where's the change? You simultaneously have the immersion in the texture of now, and you're using your mind. You have to have forethought of, oh yeah, in the third measure, we move into the bridge. There's so many kind of examples of this. So this is a technical point. When you're doing shamatha, let's say many people are working with the breath, you are not trying to focus on the breath and kind of swat away your thoughts. Sometimes you become captured by them and you have to release them. You recognize you've been captured. Or more subtly, as your attention becomes refined, you can even feel that attention is being pulled into the gravitational field of thought. Sort of like, and you recognize that attention is starting to get interested over there, moving in that direction, or towards a body sensation. And you are aware of that, and you intensify your focus to counteract that. But you can be in a maturing stage of concentration, and still occasionally thoughts are going to come and go. And if you decide, guess I'm not in concentration, it's not true. A metaphor I like is if you have a dog and you have a bone in front of it, or it's a treat, and the dog is sitting, and you move the... You ever do this? I sort of like to play with animals like this. And they're just... Right? They have the perfect concentration on that. Because if you're going to toss it, they're going to run. So they are fully alert on that cookie that you're moving. I'm like this with many things, like coffee. I do not lose sight of the coffee. Okay. But if you watch an animal, let's say there's a sound in the background, that dog's ears are alert. It's still receiving information. Its senses are still open. Its senses are open. It's having thoughts about, well, maybe I'll have to kill that cat back there, but right now I'm watching this cookie. And it will not budge. That's kind of how we're trying to practice. We keep the tracking steady despite what thoughts emit, despite what body sensations arise. Our task is the training of stable attention, so we just stay with the cookie. And this practice of attention and object touching, most traditionally the breath is taught in Buddhism, but it could be the sensations of your butt on the cushion. It could be a candle flame. It could be the sound of a bell. It really can be anything as long as you decide and commit. Without deciding and committing, the practice will never really work for you. It won't work. If you decide when I'm bored, I'm going to say that, well, the breath is boring. Shamatha will never happen. If you decide when I'm going to focus on the sensations of my hand, but if I don't like how it feels and I'm going to stop, shamatha will never work. It depends on you just saying, okay. Actually, every object has equal potential for absorption. Right? You could go into samadhi with the palm of your hand. You can go into samadhi with a candle flame. You just have to be willing to stay the course. So that's shamatha, and you can see how if you are thinking that you're supposed to also be understanding yourself and thinking about your life and introspecting, how that is going perpendicular to that practice. You can't do both. You can do a little bit of both, kind of bouncing back and forth. I don't know about chewing on your life, but shamatha is like it kind of depends on a steadiness of energy, a constancy, and then it will suddenly break into deeper domains. You're just in it and you're doing it, even though you might not be getting the feedback you like, you stay with it, and then suddenly it will deepen. The focus will just go to another level. Right? There are stages that are mapped out by many traditions of these kind of things. And so that means that sometimes it's boring until it's not. Or it's not exciting until it is. Right? Like it is, in a way, like a door you have to keep on knocking at with faith that it opens. And the way it opens is mind becomes more clear and more stable. And you're just here with less and less effort. Okay. So that is one mode of practice. Most, I think, teachers would agree with me when I share the opinion that this is the practice that most people are best suited for, because we're a highly, highly stimulated mental culture. And so there are practices that might sound sexier, but we can't do them. Because if the mind is always abuzz with a lot of thought, there's not yet the stable clarity to do the more subtle practices. Generally, we don't like to hear that. Generally, that's why we go back to YouTube and look for the person who will tell us something different. Okay, that's fine. It's not going to be forever that shamatha is the best practice for us. So the next Zen practice technically is called vipassana, or direct insight. Vipassana, the way it was translated into Chinese and then Korean and Japanese, is something like that you would use the character for eye, for seeing. You're seeing directly. In other words, vipassana means to see the nature of experience without the conceptual mind in the way. And so, with a good foundation of shamatha, we gain the ability for attention to be stable in the midst of the activity of mind, body, and the senses. We can actually look directly at the nature, for example, of thought without getting drawn into its content. Most of us, as soon as we look at thought, we are involved in the content of what the thought's about. But insight is about what is thought at all? What happens if, what can I know in my own experience if I just rest attention on mental events themselves? Because attention is stable in the midst of the movement of body sensation, the movement of mind, it can see. In other words, there's already a capacity for the Buddha's wisdom. It's just that we lose it because we're entangled with thought. And because mind is not at rest, we lose a particular kind of capacity. So disentangled attention regains wisdom capacity. And there are traditional things that the Buddha and successive ancestors suggested we pay attention to when we have that stability. For example, the flux and flow of experience. The theory to test out is that to directly see the impermanence of every body-mind moment is freeing. Why is that? The theory is that to shine the attention right on mind itself is freeing. Why is that? Another form of stable of insight when there is stable attention is to see the non-identity of things. When attention is stable, we can watch thoughts arise and disappear, and we clearly know that's not me. That's not mine. We clearly know sensations of the body arising and disappearing, and we know that's not me, that's not mine. There is a shift in that we are not, to use the Buddha's word, self-making. We are not making me and mine out of this interdependently arising experience. And that's freeing. There's peace in that. So this is not a roaming when we're doing in a Zen style direct insight or vipassana. It's not, some people do this thing, I don't know where it came from, called open awareness, where they kind of say, well, my practice is open awareness and I just kind of look at what comes up. That may be an okay practice, that is definitely not a Zen practice. There's no free roaming, let me just look at what comes up practice in Zen. Direct insight has a clear intent. You are directly looking at a particular place, a clear domain of attention, for example, the body. If we put a stable attention on the body, we can see that there's just as much space in the body as there is the experience of matter. We can see that we have a body image in our minds, and it actually doesn't map onto the felt experience. Begin to get freed from body image. We become freed from the sense that the body is solid, and experientially it becomes more like a field of energy. That's not going to happen if you're just attending to whatever captures your attention in a roaming style. Sometimes in Chan Zen, Sun, these are the different names for Zen tradition, direct insight is directed with a question, such as, who is hearing? Right? So then what we're doing is we're taking the mind that's stable enough to rest in the sense of being one who hears, and we're infusing that curiosity. We're letting that question inform the way we're seeing. And it's a little bit like you're just curious, like what is actually going on? And you use that question to help keep you from doing the open roaming style. No, I'm working with who is hearing. That's my method. I have to stay with that method in order to unpack its value. Koans are another way that one does vipassana practice in Zen. And that's a whole nother, what those are is a whole nother talk or talks. So if you develop enough shamatha power, you can do a practice that I sometimes teach where you just, ideally with your eyes open, you just put your attention directly on mind. You could just try that right now. Maybe you have enough stability. What happens putting the quality of awareness directly upon thinking mind? Not thinking about those thoughts. And just direct. My experience is as soon as I do that, they dissolve and I'm left with just a basic transparency. Okay, so then the third kind of practice, and this is not necessarily a hierarchy or a graduated series of steps. It depends on the teacher and the lineage. It depends on the person too. An advanced person could be doing shamatha and a beginner could be doing direct insight. There's different ways to go about this. I think the ZCO sentiment is generally we need some shamatha before we can do other things. But it's not always. There is no always in Zen practice. So there's a practice called shikantaza, which is very similar to a practice called silent illumination. Not exactly the same, not exactly different. When we're practicing silent illumination or shikantaza, we could describe this as simply to be awake with no clinging. To just sit with no goal and no opposition. In a sense, if we are offered that kind of method, we have to figure out what does that even mean? Because at first we can't do it. If we've never practiced like that, we've always thought, well, meditation was me putting my mind somewhere in particular, or me trying to get more calm or more peaceful. It can, for some people, feel like it's against their intuition of what meditation is about. And these are just descriptions of a practice which is more a spirit than a method. To just sit with no goal and no opposition. These are non-dual practices in a particular way that I mean non-dual. When you're practicing shikantaza or silent illumination, you're neither concentrating your attention somewhere, on an object, for example, nor are you letting it just go move around. What are you left with when you neither concentrate nor let yourself be distracted? What remains? It's non-dual in the sense that you're not seeking to improve your state of mind at all, nor are you holding on to it. What's left when you utterly let this be without even affirming that it's there in any particular way? It's non-dual in the sense that you're not engaging your discursive mind. Right? You're not letting yourself just be entangled in thought. Neither are you trying to suppress it. If you're neither entangled with thought nor trying to stop it, what's left? So in a way, this is a middle way practice. In some sense, it's very natural. In some sense, it's a very advanced practice. It's interesting that in Soto Zen, this is the main practice, and they don't have a sense of it being a beginner's practice or an advanced practice. But in Tibetan Buddhism, this is considered an advanced practice. Different ways of thinking about this. There is a way in which when you practice shikantaza, silent illumination, it is a bringing together of shamatha and vipassana. Not because you're doing both methods at the same time, because when there's no goal and no clinging, when there's no opposition to what you're experiencing because you think it should change, neither is there holding on to what you're experiencing, there's a spaciousness. When there's a spaciousness, a kind of wisdom begins to shine through. When there's spaciousness in this kind of wisdom, we just let things be. We're not trying to control life. We're not trying to have a different life. There's a calmness that just comes. There's a nowness that just arises, that just reveals itself. The good news is, at least in my opinion, all of these work and have greatly beneficial effects. The bad news, if it's bad for you, is that you have to do a lot of it to know for yourself. And again, this is part of the modern person's problem is they say, I sat down, I did that for an hour and it didn't work. And some people would think that that's a good investment of time. Like you should know after an hour whether something is gonna work or not. I'm sorry to say, a much longer span of time to know what a method of practice really has available for you. Much more time. Some people have wide eyes for when I said an hour, and I don't know if they're like, that's too long or that's too short. So the last point I want to make, this is my opinion, is that it's important to communicate or collaborate with a teacher to know what the best method is for you. You know, one extreme is that you don't know anything about your own mind and what you need. That would be an extreme kind of view. Another extreme is that I don't need a teacher. I completely have this. Nobody can see me. That would be another extreme. Somewhere in the middle, there's the possibility for collaboration. And it may be that someone who's done this, a lot of this for a very long time, at this moment could see your state of mind clearer than you could see it. It's a kind of humbling thing for many of us to, like, wait a sec, I thought I knew my mind, but maybe I don't know it as well as someone else can. Maybe they can see something about my practice that I don't have access to. So I think it's good to at least meet with somebody and disclose our state of mind and our intention and have them offer up a practice. And then, of course, to reiterate, fidelity to the method is really important. That's really important. Some people have collaborated with teachers and received multiple instructions, right? And one way to make use of that is to structure your sessions very intentionally. So let's say you sit 40 minutes a day. Maybe you spend 20 minutes doing shamatha and you don't dilute it. You just do shamatha. And then your little bell goes off and then you do 20 minutes of shikantaza or insight practice. So that you are getting to practice these different methods. There is some novelty, but you're also bringing in the fidelity. You're doing this, and even if it sucks, even if it doesn't feel good, even if you're bored, you do it. And then you move on. Even if you don't want to move on, even if this one's going really good, you move on to the next practice, and you do it. See, that's the hard thing. It's because we tend to cling to anything we think feels good or is working. So, if a talk like this creates anxiety about doing it right, it's probably not helpful. But if it brings some kind of discernment, like, huh, okay, I care about this, maybe I do have some bad habits, then it might be valuable. I remember I played a musical instrument for a few years before. I used to play the bamboo flute. I don't know if it was a few years. Maybe I played it for a year before I got lessons. And this teacher was like, I have to help you unlearn everything you've learned so far because you have such bad habits. The Dharma is in some ways similar. If we form bad habits in how we approach it, it can be hard to correct those if we go too long. And if you sit down, and however you're doing it, you're relinquishing, you're letting go of, you're detaching from your thinking mind. What is beyond the thinking mind will eventually, to some degree, reveal itself. And so just remember that key point. Sazen is letting go of thought. You won't fail if you have fidelity to that. Technical stuff aside. Okay? So that's what I wanted to say this morning.